The Dunedin version of the International Film Festival concluded this past week. It's been a disappointing offering this year. Either Bill Gosden is losing his grip, or the arthouse film industry has had a bit of a dip in the past year. If you know anything at all about me, you'll know that I'm interested in film in general and in arthouse films in particular. So over the years, I've acquired a reasonable collection of DVDs of films I think bear watching more than once or twice. But here, I have to confess a bad habit that's crept into my home film viewing. I've a tendency to fast-forward films or to stop them altogether, to having to avoid watch bad things happening to characters I care about. I exercise a kind of electronic censorship to cut out the sad endings that I know are embedded in the storyline. Take, for instance, the film Troy. I always stop the film at the point where Achilles has just got the love interest Briseis, the captured Trojan priestess, back off King Agamemnon, and in his happiness at having won her love, decides to leave the service of the king he despises, withdraw from the Trojan War, and sail back home to introduce his new girlfriend to his mother. I'm so longing for a happy ending for these two that I can't bear to watch what happens next when an accidental killing sets off a cycle of revenge killings that will destroy their relationship and a number of admirable characters, not to mention the city of Troy. The trouble with what I'm up to here is that art imitates life, and I'm trying to pretend that there isn't an inescapably tragic dimension to life in which human beings are often the authors of their own misery. Try as hard as I might, I can't change the fact that tragedy and loss are written into the warp and woof of our existence, and that the power of sin and death often cancel out our desire for happy endings. What God proposes to do about this situation came home to me a few years ago in a startling way when I stopped off in a church in Madrid and just about jumped out of my skin at what appeared to be a decaying corpse under a side altar. When my eyes adjusted to the gloom, I realised that I was looking at an incredibly lifelike, or should I say deathlike, depiction of Christ's body taken down from the cross with a sorrowing mother soaring above him dressed in a black cope. This scene is repeated in church after church in Spain. It's sunk into the Spanish psyche to the extent that some Spanish women are named Dolores, which means mother or woman of sorrows. If you think that's an albatross around their necks, then spare a thought for the women who are named Immaculata. We've reached that point in Matthew's Gospel where Jesus begins to speak insistently about the inevitability and inescapability of his impending cruel death in Jerusalem. The way he reacts so sharply to Peter's horrified request that he drop the whole idea shows that he's had to struggle with the temptation to walk away from his tragic destiny. Indeed, there's a film made a few years ago called The Last Temptation of Christ, which imagined that he went off to a quiet retirement, married, and died in his bed, surrounded by children and grandchildren. But the God-man Jesus Christ not only embraces the ministry of cross-bearing, but goes on to tell his inner circle that this is their vocation also, and will also be that who come after them in the Jesus community. So apparently, being a Christian requires not just right belief and right action, but also right suffering. This is as disagreeable a message to us as it was for Peter, and we need to understand why it's right at the heart of being a Christian. The wisest thing I've seen written about why God capped off the ministry of Jesus with these tragic events in Jerusalem comes from Gerard O'Hanlon when he writes, "The entire Trinity is involved in this event of the cross. The Father wants the reconciliation with us, which is effected through Christ's death, and whose fruit is the Holy Spirit in us." And in another place he writes, "The cross is the exposed place in which love appears at its most extreme and as its most itself." There is a twist in the nature of things, a warping in the way reality is assembled in this world. It's the source of human unhappiness, and the problem originated from our side of the line, not from God's. The cross is what has to happen to get this twisting, this warping out of the human story. The costliness for Jesus of what happens on Golgotha is not because God is in love with the blood and guts side of the passion story. It's what happens when real love enters the human story and comes up against the inescapably tragic dimension of human existence. Donald Lye puts it wonderfully well when he writes of God speaking his divine language into the world. And in these words, the Word made flesh, as they enter the human condition, they become translated into the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. In other words, the distortions that are at the heart of human reality cannot but help turn the life of Jesus of Nazareth into the further dimension of its death and resurrection. As God speaks the language of the kingdom, the place of always happy ever after endings, it comes up against the language of a world of often sad endings, and then becomes a story of overcoming that works through the fabric of this fallen world to transform it. Why this implicates us also can be summed up in the pithy saying, if you fail to truly love, then you'll only be half alive. But if you love effectively, then the chances are that you'll end up being killed. What Christ does is to redefine what love is. It's not just being good to those who are good to us and to the small number of people we have something in common with. It has a wider perspective on who we are and who we share ourselves with. It invites us to live with quiet courage, to address the difficult areas of life with grit and determination and realism, to receive bad news with dignity and calm, and to behave towards others wherever possible with imaginative generosity. And of course, it means being prepared to speak Christ's name with boldness and to be prepared to receive insult and mocking because we are his. The kind of determined and brave loving that goes with cross-bearing is not about the seeking out of masochistic experiences. We look to happy endings for the human story and hope for this outcome for ourselves also. And that is why the tail-end verses of today's gospel reading about judgment are all of a piece with what went before. In the final sorting out of things that amounts to God's last word on all that human beings have been up to, with its dispensing of true justice, searching judgment, and merciful determinations, the last and greatest happy ending becomes possible. The scriptwriter brings the narrative to a surprising, satisfying, and fulfilling end. No further fast-forwarding or freeze-framing will be necessary. Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.